From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2004 when a Democratic candidate for president declared that his strategy was still going to work. He had been a front runner, but after a disappointing loss in Iowa, Howard Dean wanted to rev up his supporters. He told them that they would be going to New York and Delaware and Michigan and California and Texas and Idaho, on and on, all the way to the White House. That moment, as you know, became a kind of political joke. But what Dean was doing was simply explaining his desire for the Democratic Party to be a national party, the 50-state strategy. He recently talked to Ken Rudin about that race and about how he thinks Democrats tend to shoot themselves in the foot. Is Dean right? The midterms are coming. There's a lot to discuss with a man you've known for years on public radio. Ken Rudin is the political junkie, and I'm not sure I've met anyone who has a political mind so encyclopedic. Happens to be in Rochester, and we've dragged him into the studio for the hour. Thank you for being here.
Dragged kicking and screaming. Great to be here.
Actually, you tweeted recently that things seem so grim at times it's hard to even joke or laugh anymore.
Well, yes, exactly. And some of the things I would... The kind of stuff I put on social media, Twitter and Facebook, some of it is tongue-in-cheek. Some of it maybe is a little snarky. But sometimes there's nothing funny anymore. And sometimes I want to just slump my head into my shoulders and just put my head down and say, this is not the way it used to be. I mean, look, you know, I think of the Howard Dean scream and Mara Liasson, the great political correspondent of NPR. She was there and said there was nothing weird about it.
But not in the room itself.
In the room itself. She said, look, you know, he was getting excited. They were excited. He was losing Iowa, which he was not supposed to do. A week or so before, he was the front runner. He's finishing third. He was trying to get his team excited. But now it's that was a humorous moment, but this now the humor is about mocking and vitriol and that's hardly humor anymore. It's just mean-spirited.
Well, you had him on your podcast, and you can find Ken's podcast, and you should, on krpoliticaljunkie.com. And this conversation among many stood out to me because Howard Dean was saying that, you know, he's running that race and eventually he ends up realizing he felt like he was running against his own party, that all the progressive ideals that Democrats tend to say they believe, they tend to, I don't know if he used this term, but kind of go moderate, to go with the, what they think is a safe choice, and that year it was John Kerry, but to go moderate, or maybe they pass the ACA, but then they apologize for it in the 2010 midterms, and they get rolled. And he seems to think the Democrats are kind of weak when the chips are down, and he felt that way in his own race.
Yeah, I kind of think there's a lot of truth to that. The fact is that his battles were not with the Republican Party, at least in 2003 and 2004. It was those, and I remember being in Iowa in 2004 for the caucuses, and they said, my heart may be with Howard Dean, but I want to beat Bush. I need to beat President Bush, and Kerry or Edwards were the candidates who could do it. So, and I think that battle is still going on in the Democratic Party today in the sense that do you want to go with your heart and your ideology, or do you want to go with a winner? And sometimes maybe the Hillary versus Bernie battle that's continuing in many primaries is an indication of that.
Yeah, and Dean also was one of the guys who really wanted a 50-state strategy. I mean, that's why that whole lampoon, what he said that night in Iowa, all you want, but he was committed to a 50-state strategy. That debate's still happening within Democratic circles. Look around the country. I think 34, 35 governorships are Republican. A ton of state houses are Republican. Republicans have dominated politics on the local, state, and national level pretty well for a while now. Why? Why is that, Ken?
Well, a lot of it is reaction. Remember, when you're talking about Howard Dean and the 50-state strategy, he instituted that when he became Democratic National Chair after 2005. He, under his leadership, the Democrats took control of the House in 2006. Nancy Pelosi became the Speaker, and the Democrats taking back control of the Senate. They won the House and Senate in 2006, and Barack Obama in 2008. And basically, it was because in states that the Democrats have never been competitive before, Dean made sure that there were resources in states like Mississippi where they don't run as pro-choice liberal progressive candidates, but they do work under the Democratic umbrella. And so they elected Democrats in states that usually don't elect Democrats. And so I think that Dean was always disappointed that he was never recognized for his prescience or whatever, or his leadership, because he didn't get a role in the Obama administration as he wanted. And he was always disappointed in that.
Democrats, and to some degree, depending on where they are, Republicans might argue, we'll come up with whatever strategy you want until we change gerrymandering. We ain't going anywhere. And you talked about that recently on your podcast about what the Supreme Court is or is not doing.
Well, first of all, they're not doing anything, which is surprising about that. There's a decision today coming about a big case in North Carolina where Democrats were convinced that the court was going to rule about this extreme partisan gerrymandering about the redistricting of congressional seats. And the court basically, to use a phrase tossed around a lot, they punted. Last week in Wisconsin, this week in North Carolina, and so mostly Democrats. Look, redistricting and partisan redistricting has been going on since time immemorial. I mean, Democrats did it for years in the 60s and 70s. Phil Burton, the legendary congressman from California, drew the lines to elect Democrats and defeat Republicans. Whoever has the power will use that power when it comes to redistricting. Republicans, having said all that, Republicans have taken this to an art form. I mean, they're using computers and everything that they really, what they've done with state legislatures, as in the case of Wisconsin, or in congressional seats, as in the case in Pennsylvania and North Carolina and other states, just legendary. So I kind of think that just as 2006 and 2008 were a reaction to Bush overreach on Iraq and Afghanistan and Katrina and food prices and things like that and corruption with Jack Abramoff and things like that. The Republican comeback in 2010 and again in 2014 was a reaction to overreach by the Democrats on gay marriage, for example. I remember not as recently as 2008, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, John Edwards, they were all against same-sex marriage. I mean, it seems like there was only 2008, they were all opposed it. And now, of course, if you oppose it now, you're seen as a bigot. There are some people who feel that the move in social policy went so fast that they weren't ready for it. And I think they took it out on the Democrats in 2010, just as the Democrats took it out on the Republicans in 2006.
Don't you think 2010 was also about the fact that they passed a health care bill?
Yeah, exactly.
And yet immediately half the Democrats in the House put their tail between their legs and seemed to apologize or clam up about it?
That's exactly. And that's similar to what happened in 1994 with the Democrats on gun laws and the restriction of assault weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, they voted for it and they said, well, we didn't really mean that. And a lot of them got their careers ended in 1994. Well, part of it was reaction against the Clintons and the assault weapons ban. But also, you're absolutely right. In 2010, a lot of Democrats voted for the health care plan, the Affordable Care Act. They didn't defend it as well as they should. They basically owed Nancy Pelosi almost bullied many members of their party to stay united behind Barack Obama, and a lot of them lost their seats that November.
And so here's Slate with a headline, the four major questions facing the Democratic Party if Democrats want to win in the midterms. And Slate's conclusion is that Democratic leaders can win if they are moderate in this midterm election, but long term, the electorate is moving on health care towards single payer. The electorate is moving to the left on social issues, as you mentioned. I mean, the policy, the legislation went pretty quickly, but so did public opinion. And what Slate is warning is don't just moderate now because it may cost you in the future. I wonder if you agree with that.
Well, this is very, and that's a debate. We talk about the fissions and the fissures inside the Republican Party. It's in the Democratic Party as well. We saw when Conor Lamb won that special election in Southwest Pennsylvania a few months ago, basically he ran against Nancy Pelosi. He ran pro-guns. He was a pro-life, anti-abortion rights candidate, and that was perfect with the district, in a district that Donald Trump won by 20 percentage points in 2016. So sometimes you have to run. If you want to win the seat, you have to be a Conor Lamb and run a moderate course. But as you point out on single payer, on healthcare, on so many issues, the party is clearly moving further and further to the left. The question is, will the party move so far to the left that Donald Trump could almost win re-election in 2020 by painting the Democrats, as Nixon did with McGovern in 72, as the party of acid, amnesty, and appeasement, or abortion, whatever those three A's were back in 72, painting the Democrats as the captured by the left. And of course, Donald Trump has his own issues, but not among his fellow Republicans.
Yeah, and so we'll get to that in a second. Listeners, if you want to call the program with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I don't have a nickname. If I did, it would probably be the political moron. I said Marco Rubio would be the next president because I thought that the Republican Party understood the changing demographics of this country, that putting forward a Latino who is young with a fresh face like his, it's very hard for any party to win the White House three times in a row. And I was obviously wrong in so many ways. So I make no more predictions. I don't know what's happening in 2020. I don't know what's happening in 2018. Do you expect the Democrats to win back the House this year?
Well, I'm with you on predictions. I mean,
I'm out of that business.
And you're not the political moron. If you remember the Republican autopsy after the 2012 election when Mitt Romney lost, the lesson was you ignore Latinos at your own peril. You ignore the changing demographics at your own peril. And that was supposed to be the lesson of 2012. Donald Trump ripped that up and said, no, we don't need that. We just focus on our base, focus on white resentment, focus on, you know, grievances that Obama is selling out the country and the feckless foreign policy and all that. So Trump did what nobody said he should do, and he won. So as far as predicting, look, the day of the election, you talk about predicting in advance that Marco Rubio would be the nominee or Jeb Bush would be the nominee. The day of the election, I was convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to win. If I can't predict the day of the election, I mean, I'll be, you know, for us to be sitting here in June and saying, well, what's going to happen on November 5th, 2018, let alone 2020, that's not our job. And obviously, it's a pointless exercise.
And there was also another recent moment that kind of caught not only my attention, but I think a number of conservative writers. Trump's the president's approval ratings have not been good since the start of his presidency. They've been sort of historically bad. But now he's at the highest level. Gallup has him at about 45%, which is right where George W. Bush was at this time in his president. Well, that's not true. That was he had 9/11 to contend with. Where Obama was.
Yeah.
So President Trump, in terms of his approval rating, is not at this moment a historically bad outlier. It's not. It does not portend doom in 2020. He absolutely could win re-election, and all of these moments that sometimes you hear. Often progressive-leaning commentators say, well, this is where he's going to lose people. This, the immigration, the parent-child separation policy, he's going to lose people. He's not. He's not losing his base.
I think of that all the time. I remember during the campaign, you know, when he said that thing about John McCain not being a true hero.
Sure. Was the moment.
The Billy Bush tape in Access
that
Hollywood.
That was the next moment.
Right, exactly. He's finished. So, look. That's the problem, of course, of making predictions. But it also shows that, look, I've been covering politics since 1066, basically, in a give or take. And yet, I am so wrong.
The year 1066?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. William the Conqueror. Billy and I were good friends. But no, but the point, it feels like I've been doing this forever. Yeah. And I think I used to think that I know basically what's going on, and clearly I don't, the fact that Trump's numbers are going up while the anger against his policies are rising.
Okay, and before I grab some phone calls, on that subject, the fact that he's got 45%, this is, if you're wondering, polling taken post media coverage and sort of the firestorm about what's going on at the border, which just means among his supporters, they may view this not only not as a negative thing, the parent separation, but in some ways they view it positively, and I'm going to try to at least represent what I hear the supporters say, because I don't want to be ungenerous here. They will say they're tired of federal immigration policy. They think that the borders are way too open, even though we're coming off an administration that deported more people than ever with Barack Obama. The deporter in chief, which immigration advocates will tell you. But their view is borders are too open, and that, okay, maybe it's sad taking parents away from kids, but that's the ends justify the means, and the ends are going to be people aren't going to come when they see that happening, and that's what they want.
You know, but this is one of the few smiles I have about this whole thing, because for the longest time, Donald Trump was saying this is the Democrats' policy. They were separating the children from their families. This is the Democrats' policy. And yet, Jeff Sessions, his attorney general, and everybody else in the administration say, this is a great policy. We agree with it. Zero tolerance. This is exactly what this is. And then Donald Trump says, this is such a great thing, but I have no right to make an executive order to get rid of it because it's doing such a good job. And then because of the uproar we've seen, you know, and the Republicans running for their lives, basically, over this policy, he signs an executive order.
So he did have the power to change it.
Of course.
And he did change it. But I think it helps. I think this whole thing helps him with his base. Do you agree?
I think it does, because he has not backed down on anti-immigration rhetoric. He has signed the executive order about separating. But as he said yesterday, I think it was saying basically, we're going to send them the hell back. They come here, no due process. They come here, we'll ship them right back. No judges, no court cases, no anything. They're gone. So his rhetoric on the issue of immigration has not changed despite the negative connotations and the negative coverage he's gotten in the aftermath of zero tolerance.
All right, so he calls John McCain a war hero, basically calls him a wimp, calls him a loser. That doesn't—
Not a hero. Not a hero.
Not a hero. Right. That doesn't hurt him. This border policy doesn't hurt. Certainly doesn't hurt him. There's a number. The Stormy Daniels stuff doesn't hurt him. Waved off. We'll talk about evangelicals in a moment. But let me ask you, sitting here right now today, what is it that could happen that would cause— The New York Times just did a story on Trump supporters, and the takeaway from that New York Times story was his supporters are so sick of the media being negative about Trump that they have stopped listening to whatever it is, and that only makes them defend him more, whatever the issue. So that being the case, what is the story that could happen that would he would lose those?
That question, Evan, reminds me of the famous quote of Donald Trump in 2015. That is, I could, you know, go in the middle of Fifth Avenue and kill somebody, and I would still not lose any of my supporters. So I don't know what that is. All the things you mentioned from poor— From the mocking of women to disparaging Latinos and Muslims to immigration policy to the Stormy Daniels stuff. I don't know what you could possibly top that. I mean, you remember the Edwin Edwards quote of that, you know, unless I'm with a dead girl in bed, they catch me in bed with a dead girl or a live boy, I'm guaranteed to keep winning. I don't know how he fails, at least with his base. So for all the talk about, well, maybe Jeff Flake or John Kasich is going to challenge him for the nomination in 2020. Lots of luck, guys, because they're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, it's a 90% approval rating for Donald Trump among Republicans. There is not much of a Never Trump movement out there. I mean, there are people, there are prominent figures, but there's not a big movement.
No, I can't remember any president that has as many denigrators in his own party, maybe since Lyndon Johnson. I mean, for example, whatever you thought of Richard Nixon and the two George Bushes and Ronald Reagan, there weren't Republicans going there carping about him, you know, day in and day out. But at the same time, Trump has been ripping apart his fellow Republicans from day one, too. He'll criticize the John Boehners and the Paul Ryans and the Mitch McConnells and Jeff Flake. He mocks them. Mark Sanford, one of the most conservative members of Congress, lost his job because he was not sufficiently pro-Trump. So for all the arguments that, well, why aren't more Republicans speaking out against these monstrous policies? Well, just point to Mark Sanford. He spoke out and he's gone.
Yeah. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, my guest for the hour. krpoliticaljunkie.com for his podcast and a lot more from him. Let's get some phone calls. And I'm going to start with Tony in Geneseo. Go ahead, Tony.
Hi, I'm so glad. I listen to Ken all the time, so it's really kind of an honor to talk to you, Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Tony.
I think Trump has no chance. Look, I mean, he got 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton. Now, who voted for Hillary Clinton last time who's going to vote for Trump? The flow is going to be in the other direction for sure. And, you know, the latest Gallup poll has him at 41%. So, anyhow, I mean, I get he won. You know, to me, it was really Hillary's fault. She was a really flawed candidate. And, you know, by the slimmest of margins, statistically, I mean, how could you lose the popular vote by 3 million votes and still win? That's, you know, that's like 1 in 1,000 chance. And he's probably going to get 5 million less votes this time around. Anyway, that's just my thoughts.
Well, okay, Tony.
Well, two things. First of all, I mean, yeah, Hillary Clinton may have been a poor candidate, but we are discounting the fact that James Comey had his announcement 11 days before the election saying we're reopening up the Hillary investigation. That didn't help. What Russia did on social media, that didn't help either. That Robert Mueller is trying to see if there's collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. But obviously, there were other things other than Hillary Clinton doing as a bad, poor candidate to account for what happened in 2016. But I don't think the question is whether these people who voted again for Hillary Clinton will now suddenly vote for Donald Trump. I think a lot of people may stay home. Either they feel that the system is rigged, or they're not sure about the sanctity of the voting box, or this anger, this incessant and nonstop bitterness and vitriol. People say, well, I'm just going to sit home. I'm just so discouraged. That's the fear that I think Democrats have the most. Not that they're going to vote for Trump, that they may not vote at all.
I think what the Tonys of the world might come back with is, they think that there were, 65 million people who voted for Hillary Clinton, 62 million who voted for Donald Trump, and 60-plus million who did not vote. And they're wondering how many of those 60 million who didn't vote are going to then be energized to come out.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we saw that many African Americans who voted enthusiastically for Obama in 2008 and 2012 did not come out in 2016. That's true in Philadelphia. That's true in many of the key states like Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, the states that basically put Donald Trump in the White House.
You've lit up the phones, Ken Rudin.
Oh, my God.
Well, I knew you were going to do that.
Are they calling Collect?
Can you still do?
No, they don't. No.
Remember 1-800-COLLECT? Remember how the world has changed. Bill in Pittsburgh. Next, this is Bill on with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Go ahead, Bill.
Mr. Rudin, I heard you last night. You were terrific when you could get a word in edgewise. My question to you is, which, if any, Republican congressional seats in Western New York may be vulnerable with the notion that all of the complainers, me being one, could organize and go to Tom Reed's district or go to Chris Collins' district or Fasco's and really have an impact both with our money and our time to get one of those people out of office?
Well, you know something, that's a good question. I mean, you talked about I grew up at a time when everything upstate New York was Republican. The Barbara Connibals, the Ammo Holtons, Frank Horton, everybody was a Republican congressman up here. Look.
Don't forget Ostertag.
Who? I'm sorry? You know what he's mentioned? He's mentioning Harold Ostertag because, as you well remember, before Louise Slaughter, there was Eckert.
Fred Eckert,
right. And before Fred Eckert, it was Barbara Connibal. But before that, it was Harold Ostertag. So as you know,
you're generous, Ken. I don't remember.
No, of course, nobody remembers that. but the point is, upstate New York used to be that. Anyway, the answer to the question is that I don't think Tom Reed is vulnerable. I think the other seats may be doable if there's an anti-Trump wave. But you know, the anti-Trump wave we were talking about several months ago seems to have lessened. Seems to not be as dramatically in Democrats' favor as we thought a few months ago. Again, things could change on a dime. There could be something else going on. And we'll see if this immigration policy turns into more of an albatross for the Republicans than we thought.
Well, let me grab, before I get another phone call in, let me just hit that subject with Ken. On immigration policy, Marco Rubio himself in the primaries was hurt for dabbling in sort of more of an openness, and then kind of had to flip and harden his position on immigration. Certainly the Republican Party has been consistently against more immigration or open borders. Open borders is unfair. I don't think anybody of seriousness in Washington right now is calling for fully open borders. But what about on the Democratic side? Is this a losing issue for them right now?
No, the immigration bill, no, I think it's a good issue for them.
I mean, certainly the family separation has been an emotional one on the left, not really on the right. I mean, Trump hasn't lost support from it. So that's why I ask if it's a losing. If they reform immigration that pulls the numbers in a direction that is, and again, I don't know how to describe this other than to say that Barack Obama, despite what the right thinks of him, was known as the deporter in chief, right. A lot of deportation. If Democrats now try to pass a policy, which they can't do without more numbers, but if they favor more policies that are more open to immigration? Is this a losing political issue? I'm not saying right or wrong.
Well, but we do. There is indication that when the Democrats were talking about shutting down the government because Congress would not pass something authorizing DACA or having the Dreamers giving them a path to citizenship, the Democrats did not fare well in that debate. And just as the Republicans, when they shut down the government in 2013, they were thought to be the bad guys, even though they did very well the next year in Congress. But the Democrats didn't look good with threats to shut down the government. And basically, in many districts around the country, Republicans would say, the Dreamers, they're here illegally. They broke the law. And so are we going to shut down the government to defend people who broke the law? And that's the debate between compassion and following the law to the letter of the law. And that's the debate in immigration in this country.
All right. Ken Rudin is our guest here. Joel wants to know, what do you think of George Will's recent column in which he said he wants Democrats to win the midterms?
Wow, that was pretty good. I mean, that was a knock on the head of one of those never Trumps. He was never a fan of Trump. And I remember him with a tremendous battle on the air with Bill O'Reilly on the propriety. That was pretty ugly, as we used to say. Look, there are more and more Republicans. Steve Schmidt of the McCain campaign and others, George Will. They basically feel that Donald Trump is violating or abandoning all the principles of conservatism, whether it's tariffs or trade or immigration or look. Climate control is not a very popular Republican issue, but I think the fact that the administration, with Scott Pruitt as the head of the EPA, I mean, regulations is going out the window. The laws seem to be broken. The swamp is as undrained as ever. So what he said is very interesting. I don't know who he influences, whom he influences. I don't think he influences the Fox News Republicans who are going to stick with Trump. I don't think, Martha Roby, the congresswoman from Alabama, who's been forced into a runoff because she criticized the Access Hollywood tape. I mean, she's now been endorsed by Trump because she's now on his good side. I see for every George Will, there seems to be more and more Republicans in the House and Senate. They say, I am sticking with the president and not budging an inch.
All right, back to your phones we go. This is Sarah in Rochester next. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hey, guys. So I have a lot to cover, but you can check out my Twitter at the break so you can address more of these things.
We only got half an hour left. We got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Sarah.
All right. So I was at the show yesterday at the cinema, Political Junkie, and I was just distraught afterwards. Some of the failings were logistical, but others were, pretty privilege-based. So first of all, Louise Slaughter's daughter was typically treated as women are on panels and got no time to speak. Okay, secondly, the event was titled Politics in New York State, a Forum, but apparently nobody informed the panelists and our questions were dismissed. Ken says that the Democratic Party, in theory, should be about progressive ideals, but in practice, it's not the case. And we talked about the electability of Joe Morelli, and I'd say what makes him electable is exactly what makes him unable to challenge the status quo. And I myself am working really hard to leave Rochester because I yearn to be in a place where leaders actually embrace evidence from around the world. So things like Stockton, California, a cow town, Kansas City, and in Rochester, we just say, it can't happen here. Well, we have traveled the world and I've, gone to Harvard. We want to get the best practices, bring them back to Rochester, but our leaders just are unwilling to implement those practices and we're done. So, Evan, you can tell Ken about all the things that I fight for, all the things that I email and tweet you about, and you'll tell him that Rochester will be losing a bright light when I and my fellow activist best friend will be leading in the next few months. Thanks.
Sarah, thanks for the phone call. She's fired up, and there's a lot there, but let me just kind of like distill that a little bit, Ken. Her concern is she heard from you, that it's just not pragmatic for Democrats to kind of fight for values. And that's how, in her words, she gets the kind of Democratic candidates that she doesn't want to see, that aren't as progressive as she
is. I will never argue that Democrats should not fight for their values. And what I do say is that is a debate going in with the Democratic process right now between the more progressive, let's say, the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, who feels that income inequality and justice and things like that are non-negotiable, whereas you know, I guess I did have some implied criticism of Hillary Clinton last night, but in her career, she has been a cautious candidate. She has moved to the center in many issues. And so there is that debate going in the Democratic Party. I will never say that the Democrats should not fight for their ideals, nor should I say that conservative Republicans shouldn't fight for their ideals. That's what politics is all about. I may not be as optimistic as Sarah was. And I remember Sarah, of course, last night at the instance at the event. But having seen, for example, we always talk about nothing will ever get done with guns, even though the fact that 32 children or 22 children were slaughtered in Newtown, Connecticut, and yet a few months later, nothing happened. Even waiting period was not extended in the Senate. I mean, that is just unconscionable. But you have these kids in Parkland who marched to Tallahassee, changed the law there. So I don't know how long these things take to happen, but activism still has its value. And as we saw in Florida, they can make a big, big difference. I will never argue, and I certainly didn't argue last night, that this kind of activism is a waste of time.
Hmm. Okay. Back to the phones. John in Henrietta next. Go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed your show on Wednesday afternoons. You were fantastic, and I should have never taken you off.
Thank you. You're talking about Talk of the Nation with the political junkie.
Yes.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Oh, yes, I know.
Is there any chance you'll come back?
Well, Evan has talked about, actually, I shouldn't be saying this on the air, but Evan has talked about quitting himself and giving me his show, his program every day between 12 and 2.
He's moving around.
No, actually, Evan never said that. I lied. It's fake news.
That is fake news.
No, but thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I spoke to Neil Conan yesterday. We had a great run and we missed it a lot.
Oh, well, I know people miss Neil and Ken, but we can still find him on so many different places, not the least of which is the podcasting that you do, and you talk to people all across the spectrum. It's krpoliticaljunkie.com if you want to get online with Ken Rudin, who is our guest for this hour. I wanted to ask you before.
Can I just interrupt one quick?
Yeah.
You know, Neil now runs a macadamia nut farm in Hawaii, Neil Conan does. And I said to him, I said, you left me to run a nut farm? I mean, there's something weird about it. There's something strange about that. Okay, I'm sorry.
Actually, it seems consistent.
Exactly.
Okay,
you're right.
I see where you're going. I see what you did there. But I wanted to ask you, outside of politics, what I'm going to ask you is who your favorite political guest is. And that doesn't mean whose politics you like. Because the truth is, for listeners, we like people who are fun to talk to, who are forthcoming,
absolutely,
who don't give you scripted answers, right, who aren't just reading the talking points.
Right.
Who stands out to you?
Wow. Well, I mean, Howard Dean is a perfect example because he said basically that I ran a lousy campaign. You know, I'm not a good speaker. It was honest. He put a lot of the blame on himself. I mean, I thought Howard Dean was can be over the top. I thought his squabbles with Gephardt about this and that, it just seemed like just too much. But I like people exactly who are introspective, who are honest. You know, I remember so many stories where I interviewed, when I was with ABC News, I remember interviewing Ted Kennedy. And it was scripted answer. It was just not going well at all. And he was fumbling over anything he said. I stopped the camera and said, let's take a breath, because he was all over the place. And he started showing me pictures of his family around his office. And then when I had that personal rapport, that personal conversation, we started again. It was a different Ted Kennedy. So I think everybody's capable of having a warm and introspective conversation, but you can't just start cold and expect them to be your best friend.
By the way, speaking of Ted Kennedy, did you see Chappaquiddick, the new film?
I didn't, and I didn't have a desire to.
No?
I heard it was a little, I heard it was a little, it didn't get into the things I would have liked to have gotten into. I mean, Ted Kennedy is not a sympathetic figure in Chappaquiddick, in the actual thing that happened in Chappaquiddick. And I think there were a lot of things that were overlooked in that movie, the way what I read about it.
But he shouldn't be a sympathetic figure.
No. I'm saying, but I think he was more sympathetic in the movie than he should have been.
Having seen the movie, I don't think most people are going to be sympathetic to him. But
okay,
let's not derail on Ted Kennedy. We got so much more to talk about with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, who is in studio with us for the duration of the hour. Another John. This is John in Rochester. Next on the phone, go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Ken, I'm waiting for Evan to jump on the Trump train. One of these days I'll convince him. But listen, Ken, on a more serious note, the scandals that I think are really – the shoe's going to drop, I think, on this Justice Department scandal, FBI scandal, and even the CIA with John Brennan and Clapper with one of the other intelligence agencies. I think this could be bigger than Watergate. The collusion between the intelligence agencies, the Justice Department, and the FBI. What are your thoughts on that and really creating a huge scandal in the Obama administration? These were pretty much Obama appointees, Obama people. Is this shoe going to drop, and is this going to help Trump?
Well, look, that is the Trump argument, and I understand what he's saying. But my understanding, John, is that under the Obama administration and in the CIA and the FBI during the campaign, there were legitimate concerns that two members of the Trump campaign, George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, were having meetings with Russians. I don't know what the extent of it was, but they were either promising dirt or they were getting promises of dirt from Hillary Clinton. But there seemed to be the fact that they were doing seemingly underhanded business with Russians gave the FBI reason to investigate the Carter Pages and the George Papadopoulos for their connections to Russia. I understand that it's, you know, what Trump has been trying to say is that this is proof that they wanted Trump defeated. This was a collusion by Obama and Hillary and the CIA and Clapper and Brennan and all those people. I don't buy it. If the FBI wanted Donald Trump defeated, they wouldn't have interfered 11 days to go before the election with this stuff about Hillary Clinton investigation opening up. So I think that what upsets me is that the doubts people now have of our intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the Justice Department, as well as the doubts that Trump is trying to convince us of with the media. The media has suddenly become the enemy of the American people. I feel that these institutions, these American institutions, are being called into question as part of Donald Trump's basic campaign to say that everybody's lying and the only one you could trust is myself. When Tucker Carlson said the other day, you should watch nothing else but Fox News, it was part of that. It's us against them. We are right and everybody else is wrong. Look, John, look, there are a lot of reasons why the election of Donald Trump made sense. He promised conservative judges. He delivered. He promised a conservative foreign policy. He has delivered. He promised tariffs. I mean, he's been about that forever.
And he's delivered.
He delivered, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's the nastiness, the bigotry, the seeming untruths. That's what just rips my heart out. And again, it's nothing to do with ideology, not because he's a Republican. I just think that it's just that this facts don't mean anything anymore. And it breaks my heart to say that.
Well, Ken, I have to disagree with you in a lot of what you say. I respect what you say, but I disagree with a lot.
And I respect that, too.
I think there's going to be a big shoe that's going to drop. I think this investigation by Mueller the tables are going to be turned. And it might even reach Mueller, although I doubt it. But I think you're going to see a Watergate situation bigger than Watergate. Watergate is nothing compared to the unmasking and everything else that went on.
Well,
and Trump's not the only one. There's a lot of credibility in a lot of different sources out there. And I think you may be wrong on this one.
Now, John, we talked earlier this hour. I mean, I understand your position on the Justice Department stuff, but is there something that this president could do that would lose your support?
Oh, of course. If he truly increased taxes, if he truly had a racist policy. In effect, and I don't think he has done that at all. He's done things that
What would a racist policy look like apart from what we've seen? What would a racist policy actually look like?
Well, if he banned all Muslims from coming into the country, he hasn't done. There's 56 or 60 Muslim dominated majority countries, and I think his ban applied to five or six. If he applied the ban to all 60 or whatever, 56 or whatever it is, I'd have second thoughts about that. At this point, there are things that he could do that would turn me against him. But I think Donald Trump is a true liberal. I think right now the left, when people call the left liberal, that's not true at all. I think Trump's more of a liberal than most of the left. I'm a liberal. I look at both sides of an argument. The left is off the rails. The true liberals are gone.
All right. Thanks, John. Classical liberal, I think, is what he was going for. Okay. Go ahead, Ken.
I mean, look, I understand what Donald Trump brought to this. There was an exasperation in this country about the status quo that just wasn't working. The things about, as I said, about Obama, social policy moving too fast. But the fact that like, for example, Charlottesville. If to me, the fact that, there were good guys on both sides of this issue, equating basically the protesters with the white supremacists, if that's not a racist, if not a racial policy, then I don't know what is. And I'm not meaning to pick a fight with John, because, again, I could see the argument for conservatism after 8 years of Barack Obama, and that's fine. But, again, it's the going beyond. It's the white supremacist websites and the winks and the code words used. That concerns me.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's the blank hole comments about foreign countries and then comparing those kind of immigrants to people from Norway.
Right.
Who are almost uniformly white. There's plenty of evidence, John, all the way going back to Trump and his father denying rental opportunities for people of color, that racism does exist with this president. And I don't mean to be rude about that. I'm just observing it. And, you know, John joked he's going to try to get me on the Trump train. My view as the host of this program is irrelevant. And some of our listeners probably think that I inject too much. And I probably do at times. You do 500 hours a year. It's hard, you know. But I have said that the civility part of it's hard for me, that this president is beyond, you know, the way he treats people, the way he talks about women, the way he talks about people of color has been hard.
And that's why seeing it come in response from the left, the Sarah Sanders, Sarah Huckabee Sanders stuff, the Kirstjen Nielsen,
yeah.
the response by the left using the same kind of tactics is very disheartening, because we've become like them. We, meaning people who would never do that kind of stuff, have become like them. So I think there's a certain intolerance on the left. We know there's intolerance on the right, and that's clear. But the fact that the intolerance on the left is matching that, I just think that we're just, you know, doomed.
Okay, so what Ken's talking about there, if you missed it, we're going to talk about it at noon tomorrow. We've got a panel of restaurant owners who are talking about their views on whether they would serve Sarah Huckabee Sanders or a member of the Trump administration. This past weekend, Sarah Huckabee Sanders dined or tried to dine at a place called the Red Hen, and they politely told her that they would not be serving her for her role with the Trump administration. She tweeted about it. It started off this firestorm. Is that the right thing to do? That, of course, followed on the heels of people like Stephen Miller going out to eat at a Mexican restaurant on the week of the border crisis, which, by the way, is just pure trolling to do that. But he gets shouted at, and people are saying, is that the right thing to do? So you don't like it, Ken. You don't like the whole don't serve people at...
I don't. But I do know that the Trump people probably feast on it, no pun intended, but I think they do. And you know something, in fairness, the thing that happened to Sarah Huckabee Sanders came, I think, a day or so after her father, Mike Huckabee, tweeted a photograph of the Latino-looking menacing gang, and he said, this is Nancy Pelosi's campaign committee to win back the House. If that's not a racist...
That's racist.
That's what I thought it was, too.
It's racist. I mean, we're allowed to say it's obviously racist. And so John, who just called in, check out what Mike Huckabee tweeted. Tell me if you think that was racist. Because if you don't, that's a bridge too far for me, and we're never going to fill that gap. But I think we're going to talk more about this tomorrow on the whole what's the appropriate response and what is not. And people are emotional, and people are frustrated.
Yeah.
But I think there are times where there's almost a baiting going on. When Melania Trump wore the I don't care, do you jacket, I think that was obvious baiting to get so the Trump administration could say, oh, look, the media is just fixated on her wardrobe. So I think we should just not talk about it. I also think that's one of the most immature things I've ever seen.
Why would she do that?
Because it's immature. And it's a good way to get the media talking about a woman's wardrobe. And we did it. We did it.
But I look, the person is, she's supposed to come down with a human face and some sympathy for these children in the Texas border town who are in this detention camp. And basically, you know, I mean, for all the criticisms of Donald Trump, they have not been extended to Melania Trump. And yet she comes down wearing that message. And Donald Trump says it's her way of saying that she doesn't believe the media at all. She knows that the media is dishonest, and that's the message she was sending. I mean, what? Why do you do that when the ostensible purpose is to meet with kids who are in a tough situation?
I agree.
But then again, when you see the Robert De Niro thing and the Samantha thing.
I think the Robert De Niro thing was as ridiculous as anything.
I agree.
It just does no good.
And then everybody stood up and gave him a standing ovation.
And that is not bravery to say, you know, blank Trump in front of a big audience of people who agree with you.
Exactly, of liberals on Broadway, no.
Yeah, that's not resistance.
No.
And that's only going to be played among Trump supporters.
Of course.
Saying, well, look at that, they all hate it.
And Samantha Bee, too, just, the thing she said about Kellyanne Conway.
Okay, but people are frustrated. They're emotional. And here's an email from Herman. He says, in a politically divided country, the conventional wisdom is that, at least for national races, you need candidates who are moderate enough to be acceptable to the swing voters in the political center. Historical examples include Nixon, George H.W. Bush, Carter, Clinton, Obama. Examples from recent special elections would be Senator Doug Jones, Connor Lamb. Ideologically extreme presidential candidates in the past who lost spectacularly include Goldwater and McGovern. And he goes on to say, Democrats seem to be fielding candidates who are the most progressive candidates that can be found, and do they risk losing winnable elections and blowing their chance to flip the House?
Depends on the district. I think I think one of the lessons that Democrats are learning is that a Connor Lamb, which worked in Southwest Pennsylvania, is not going to work in, you know, liberal in Madison, Wisconsin, for example. So I think you have to pick and choose. We always talked about the Republican big tent. The Democrats may feel that, look, Bernie Sanders backed the candidate for mayor of Omaha, Nebraska, even though he was pro-life, because he felt that he was very good on economic equality, and that was kind of issue he would support. So I don't think one size fits all for the Democrats anymore. And if they think it does, then they're making a mistake.
All right, back to the phones we go. And this is Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Well, a couple things. Earlier, your guest indicated a comment about people needing some more time to wait for people to get their rights. I want to point out that in this country, as many other countries too, probably, is that a lot of the changes have come about because people at grassroots levels who saw injustice, you can name a whole bunch of issues that covers, they're the ones that actually has pushed this country. It's a long battle. Unfortunately, it shouldn't be that long. But then the political folks kind of, either somebody gets elected from that group or they have people that are more sympathetic, and they start to make those follow up on those changes. But I think this is an extremely important point that we don't pay enough attention to those histories. And I don't mean just by naming them. I mean just what is, for instance, very little labor history is taught in schools. I used to argue with people all the time, you know, teachers included. You know, how do you expect people to feel like they can make changes if you don't even tell them the history? That's one other point. The other point that I think cannot be said enough, and I really wish the media would kind of follow up on this a little bit more, and I know it's not easy, is that Donald Trump represents people that he has a lot of character flaws. But let's not pretend. If we were talking in a mental health tone, we would have him listed. And I don't mean that just as a sarcastic remark. That is absolutely the truth. And so what he knows how to do, and look at his friends, Roger Stone, Roy Cohen, they know how to disrupt things. And they do it for and whatever the theme of the day is, they don't have ideology, have nothing. So they just keep doing it. And what we are vulnerable to is because a lot of our population does not understand what real racism is. They don't go deeper in their own lives. There's not a school system that really, you know, do that. New York State does not require, for example, teachers to have anti-racism training at deep levels. So what do we expect? We have people on race, on class, that are still hung up on women having too much power. People of color, you know, who are they? We'll just, you know, put them down so we can't stand the fact that they have power or they're smart or whatever. And the list goes on. So we have to acknowledge that, and we have to deal with it. And the way to deal, one of the ways, is education. The other is to talk to people who say, I'm for Trump because of culture. What the heck does that mean? You have to own what you say. You can't just say some blippy thing and then have the reporter just go on, what's the next subject? So thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. So on the subject of culture, let's work backwards. We only got a couple of minutes here. Evangelical voters used to be the leading bloc of voters in this country who would say that someone's personal conduct in private matters to their public governing. And now that has flipped. They are, as a bloc, they voted very strongly for Trump, and they say, it doesn't matter what you do in private. Evangelicals. And so Bonnie's saying, what happened to culture? What do you mean by that? Do you see a connection there?
Well, that's a very good point, and I don't know how to explain that as well. I mean, we know we have a list of 1,000 members of Congress or politicians who lost their jobs because of personal failures, and they were opposed.
Both parties, major parties,
right?
But long list.
But in fairness, though, the people, the Me Too movement that's going on today, this was the same movement that was. With Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1993, they were saying, look, it was the bimbo eruption and Bill Clinton should be defended as the women should be criticized. So I think, to me, it's galling to watch Donald Trump bring ex-Bill Clinton women to these debates while he's talking about grabbing women in the Access Hollywood tape. But something has happened with evangelicals that they once stood up for something, at least whatever they stood up for. They believed in family values, whatever that means. And to back Donald Trump, who is the absolute opposite of family values, is just startling. And I don't know. You know, I just don't know how to explain that at all.
Yeah, I mean, you can back Donald Trump or anybody for any number of reasons, but if you're an evangelical who has always said family values, and this is the guy that you backed, it just means that really never had any meaning for you. The accumulation of power is what it was about.
That's absolutely true. I've never, again, candidates in the past that the evangelical community would dismiss, the fact that they're backing Donald Trump and not backing away at all is just remarkable.
I want to do this once a week with you. We can't. So where can people see more of you, Ken?
Well, I think you can see more of me on krpoliticaljunkie.com. I'm very good looking on the internet. and thinner.
krpoliticaljunkie.com. Podcasting, interviews, and a lot more. And I greatly enjoyed it. Ken Rudin, we've enjoyed you so much over the years, and we continue to. Our listeners really appreciate it. So do I. Thank you for being here.
I appreciate it. It was a great hour. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.